You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the December 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Alone, together, small faces on a smudgy screen helped conjure a future, one that holds pleasure and hope, by Kizzy McCabe-Lehman, with opening photo by McNair Evans, showing a room with sun streaming in through the blinds. Early this morning, my mailman read me a story, two stories actually. I met my mailman, Sean, in July. While sitting on my porch, Sean had walked up and asked if Biggie Smalls was my favorite MC. Before I could answer, Sean said he noticed the portrait of Biggie in my sunroom. Sean placed my delivery on the steps and asked why I had so many books delivered. I told Sean I was a reader and writer. Sean told me he'd never taught, but that he was a writer, too. I sat out on that porch, listening to Sean rap 1.5 songs about his old life in Kansas City and recite the synopses of two projects he needed to finish. I'm not sure if they're screenplays or novels or short stories, he told me. This morning, I listened over speakerphone as Sean read the first 5 handwritten pages of the two stories he started on my porch. I lay on my bed, the back of my head buried deep into a down pillow that 10 minutes earlier I held like a soft someone I hoped would not leave. I never dreamed that my mailman, asking me about the most effective use of third-person point of view, would be what pleasure on a summer Sunday morning felt like. Like so many of my friends, my past 8 months have been spent dodging death, mourning the dead, creating art, and loving black people. I've lingered in socially distant conversations with strangers. I've cried and laughed at what made me cry and laugh. I've made recipe-less meals that were so nasty, all I could do was giggle in the middle of every bite. I've tenderly touched parts of my body I'd forgotten. I found that pulling the hairs out of my corona beard is actually soothing. I've reread, rewritten, revised. I've done all of this not simply in the hopes of feeling good, but because I long to feel less like we are going to die tomorrow. I am a black southern writer from Mississippi. That is my superpower. Aloneness is our fuel. Loneliness our fire. But this, whatever this is, hurts in a new way. Folks across the political spectrum have talked a lot about normalcy this year, prognosticating when and how we'll get back to it. In response, there have been heaps of brilliant essays, speeches, and webinars about how the obliteration of an inequitable normal is the first step in creating a place where abusers of power are held accountable and the vulnerable actually have equitable access to healthy choices and first, second, and third chances. When this new normal is created or accepted, I wonder what will happen to sentimentality. That gorgeous monster James Baldwin called the ostentatious parading of excessive and spurious emotion the mark of dishonesty in art, artists, and the audiences who give us life. How will we distinguish what feels good from what is supposed to feel good when all of our skies are orange and every stranger's touch is a violation? After not having touched another human for over 3 months, the night before I talked with Sean, I drove to one of the only restaurants in town that still only offers curbside service. I touched the finger of a masked woman who brought Thai fried rice with tofu, level 4, to my truck. I tipped her as much as the meal cost and thanked her for committing to curbside. She put the tip in her pocket and thanked me for committing to her restaurant. There's a sentimental version of this story where, exploitation be damned, we both wait until we are out of each other's sight to clean our hands, take off our mask, and nod our heads slowly up and down at the grit, grind, and grandeur of Americans. I did not live that version of the story. The kind woman who accepted my money went directly from my truck to the car next to me. I cried alone in my truck. Later that night, I saw that someone sent me a clip of a brother who goes by the name of Dogface208 gliding on a skateboard from the highway on-ramp with a half-drunk 64-ounce bottle of Ocean Spray Cran raspberry juice in one hand and a phone recording himself in the other. 16 seconds into the video, Dogface208 bends at the waist and sings into the air. I watched the clip a second time with sound, and everything changed. I noticed Dogface208's familiar nod to us, and really him is so in the pocket of the song. As Stevie Nicks sings, "Now here we go again, you say you want your freedom." I notice trucks, factories, and two tattooed feathers behind Dogface208's ear. I see yellow and white lines marking the margins of the highway. I see how baggy and plush his gray sweatshirt is. I notice the familiar way he smacks his lips, relishing the punchy sweetness. I feel, with every ounce of joy in my body, Dogface208's acceptance of fear and joy when he bends and lip-syncs the lyrics. "It's only right that you should play the way you feel it." I'd heard and loved Fleetwood Mac's Dreams thousands of times, but I'd never felt the freedom and loneliness I felt when watching Dogface208's TikTok. The video didn't make me forget that many of us are dying, dead, or mourning. The clip gave me another portal of entry into pleasure and movement. Dogface208 bended and really blended my gendered, raced, classed, and placed expectations of revolutionary desire and art. "But listen carefully to the sound of your loneliness," is the next line of the song we do not hear. 3 mornings later, I am sitting in front of a smudged computer screen. 68 mostly black high school students from Baltimore's City Neighbors High School have invited me into what in 2020 we call a classroom. I am expected to read a chapter from my new book and teach the young people about the multiple uses of point of view in narrative art. I do not want to do what is expected of me, because what is expected of me will not feel good to anyone. I ask the students if they'd rather talk about fear and joy and concrete language. The only rule of the exercise is there are no abstractions allowed. 2 hours later, my computer, our classroom, is closed. I'm on my knees wondering why I am energized, satisfied, but not sobbing. 68 young people from Baltimore did what our geriatric presidential candidates and moderator could not do the night before. They used word patterns they'd never used. They talked freshly about fear of isolation. They collectively unraveled how capitalism encourages a speed that makes love, pleasure, and actual contemplation nearly impossible. They wondered why school didn't teach them how to gracefully lose and graciously win. They made critiques of the nation and critiques of themselves. They listened to each other toe the thinnest of lines between yearning for pleasure and aching for escape. They accepted that they are worthy of the most exquisite joy. They argued vigorously about the ethics of seeking pleasure at the expense of essential workers, like many of their parents, who put their lives on the line for a tomorrow filled with remedies to overdue rent, grocery bills, bludgeoning debt. They wondered how to make essential labor into pleasurable labor for essential laborers when the nation insists on treating them as expendable at best and big-hearted collateral damage at worst. Those 68 12th graders made themselves feel good. Then they thanked each other for making themselves feel good, all the while pulverizing my understanding of sentimentality. Later that night, I am sent an essay I read the first time one day after September 11, 2001, called Blood, Bread, and Poetry. Nothing need be lost, the exquisite Adrienne Rich wrote. No beauty sacrificed. The heart does not turn to stone. I love Adrienne Rich. I have believed Adrienne Rich my entire reading life. I am not sure I believe this Adrienne Rich passage anymore. Beauty is absolutely sacrificed. Our hearts often do turn to stone. This arduous acceptance is a radical pleasure, a sad but sensuous reminder that we are worthy of looking forward to responsibly feeling good in a world of ruin. Where presidents shed their COVID-filled mask, wash their nasty hands of death, and the blood drips from the sky. When the rain washes us clean, we will know. We will feel so good, I believe that. If we find, however, that the rain has actually left more bruises, soaked us in more sour than we ever imagined, and if that bruised sour feels so good, it is then that the pleasurable work actually begins. Many of our hearts are stone. Much of the beauty here has been sacrificed, and most of it stolen. There is no commercial, doctor, or wellness regimen to smudge that truth. Home is gone, but there is responsible pleasure to be found in the wreckage, in the pathways of the wrecked, and in all the goodness beyond where we've been allowed to discover. Everything, finally, is lost. Now, here's this month's cover story. Becoming AOC. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on how she got here and where she's headed by Michelle Ruiz. Photographs by Tyler Mitchell. Sittings editor Carlos Nazario. Fashion director Nicole Chapoteau. Opening photo, America's Left Hook. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, photographed in October 2020 in New York City. Her Republican colleagues had, up until then, been civil. But one day in late July, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez stood on the steps of the U.S. Capitol while Representative Ted Yoho lost his shit. The Florida Republican, incensed by the New York Congresswoman's recent comments linking crime and poverty, jabbed his finger in her face, calling her crazy and disgusting. She froze. The situation felt dangerous, with Yoho towering over Ocasio-Cortez, who calls herself 5'5 on a good day. Congressman Roger Williams, a Texas Republican, bumbled next to him like a wind puppet at a used car dealership. She told Yoho he was being rude and went into the Capitol to vote. As Yoho descended the steps, he called her an effing bitch. A reporter nearby witnessed the exchange, and soon the whole world had heard the epithet. This part hasn't been reported. The next day, Ocasio-Cortez approached Yoho and told him, "You do that to me again, I won't be so nice next time." She felt his actions had violated a boundary, stepping into the zone of harassment, discrimination. His mocking response, straight out of Veep, "Oh, boo-hoo." Publicly, Yoho doubled down, issuing a non-apology on the House floor, citing his wife and daughters as character witnesses. Ocasio-Cortez flashed back to one of her first jobs out of school, when a male colleague, whom she'd edged out for a promotion, called her a bitch in front of the staff. She had been too stunned to reply, and no one came to her defense. She wouldn't let it happen again. 48 hours later, Ocasio-Cortez delivered one of the most eloquent dunks in political history. A thank you next for the C-SPAN set, taking on not just Yoho, but the patriarchy itself. She took care to enter effing bitch into the congressional record. "I want to thank him for showing the world that you can be a powerful man and accost women," she told the House. "It happens every day in this country." And the line that spawned headlines, T-shirts, hashtags, and memes, "I am someone's daughter, too." The 2020 horse race may have been between two white male septuagenarians, but it was a millennial Puerto Rican Democratic socialist who produced a seminal political moment. Her Yoho rebuke inspired a fresh wave of awe for the youngest U.S. congresswoman in history and cemented her status as neo-political icon. Not just good on Twitter, where she schooled her congressional colleagues in a tutorial, and Instagram Live, where she gave an impromptu address on the dark night of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death, but a skilled orator with the power to move even her most cynical congressional colleagues. They were like, "I didn't know you're that eloquent," Ocasio-Cortez says with a wry smile. "I'm so pleased and surprised by your restraint." Ocasio-Cortez does not name Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and in a separate conversation rejects reports of a clash, calling it media-manufactured misogyny. "Two powerful women coming from different perspectives," she shrugs, "and there has to be a catfight." Still, House leadership is sometimes a little wary of me speaking on the floor. "Not that I'm not allowed to, but it's a little more dicey," says Ocasio-Cortez. "I think a lot of people, including my Democratic colleagues, believe the Fox News version of me." Most of Ocasio-Cortez's family and close friends call her Sandy. A few, like Representative Ayanna Pressley, go with Alex. But becoming AOC and at AOC has simultaneously vaulted her into a pantheon of triple-initialed legends and alternately given a handy tagline to the right's worst nightmare. Her beatific face is commodified on Twee Etsy greeting cards, "I AOC, it's your birthday," and stamped alongside those of RBG and Frida Kahlo on feminist prayer candles and Latina icon stickers. Conservative attack ads depict her as a socialist villainess. One equally disturbing spot shows a photo of her face on fire before cutting to a pile of skulls. It's very dehumanizing in both ways, strangely, both the negative and the positive, the Congresswoman tells me one afternoon from behind the desk of her Bronx campaign office. It's not an accident that every cycle the boogeyman of the Democrats is a woman, says Ocasio-Cortez. A couple of cycles ago it was Pelosi, then it was Hillary, and now it's me. From her swearing-in in January 2019, Ocasio-Cortez became the de facto spokeswoman for the historically diverse 2018 midterm class, including a record 36 women and 24 people of color as freshmen in the House. Yoho's outburst on the Capitol steps was a painful illustration of how some in the entrenched ruling class greeted their arrival, a finger in the face of change. AOC's status as overnight sensation unsettled some in Washington. I've never seen folks who were in the gallery get all excited about seeing a member of the Oversight Committee, says Representative Peter Welch, a Vermont Democrat and friend. Other members are jealous. She has demonstrated a special talent for triggering white male fragility on both ends of the political spectrum. 3 months after her 2018 primary, Andrew Cuomo dismissed her victory as a fluke. Ron DeSantis, a congressman at the time, called her this girl or whatever she is. That demographic of Politico are allowed to be wunderkinds. Joe Biden was 29 when he first won his Senate seat. Mayor Pete Buttigieg launched a presidential bid at 37, the same age as Tom Cotton when he ascended to the Senate. But we are not used to seeing young women of color in positions of power, says journalist Andrea Gonzalez Ramirez, an early chronicler of AOC's rise. Even back then, her public profile came with a threat of danger. A month into Ocasio-Cortez's first term, a Coast Guard lieutenant and self-described white nationalist was arrested in Maryland with a stockpile of guns and a plot to kill Ocasio-Cortez, Senator Kamala Harris, Pelosi, and others. His internet search history included "Where in D.C. to Congress Live." "Where in D.C. to rather Congress Live," and that's sick, because it's "Where in D.C. to." He eventually pleaded guilty to federal drug and gun charges. Around the same time, Ocasio-Cortez came home to the D.C. apartment she shares with her partner, Riley Roberts, to find a man with a camera parked in a dark car outside. She ran to the back of a grocery store, fearing she might be attacked. The next day, a right-wing outlet published photos of her address, blurring it only after her office complained. The death threats seemed to spike in concert with Fox News rhetoric. I used to wake up in the morning and literally get a stack of pictures that were forwarded by Capitol Police or FBI, like, "These are the people who want to kill you today," she says. The torrent of abuse spread to her mother, Blanca, and her younger brother, Gabriel. "It's the epitome of being shaken to your core," Gabriel says, getting a phone call from the FBI saying, "Hey, don't open your mail. They're mailing out bombs." A designer of AOC's Cesar Chavez-inspired campaign posters gets death threats. Her former dean at Boston University, who introduced Ocasio-Cortez in a 2011 speech viewable on YouTube, regularly fields emails calling him the N-word for training her. When President Trump lobs one of his attacks at Ocasio-Cortez, he has called her everything from a poor student to a whack job. Her offices are flooded with calls, voicemails, and emails echoing him. The hate escalated as Ocasio-Cortez traveled to a border detention center in Texas in July 2019, just as the horrors of the Trump administration's family separation policy were coming to light. In a secret Facebook group, current or former U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents shared altered images depicting Ocasio-Cortez, who had called the center's concentration camps, in graphic acts, ProPublica reported. "Did you see the images of officers circulating photoshopped images of my violent rape?" Ocasio-Cortez later asked then-Department of Homeland Security Chief Kevin McAleenan at a House hearing. Touring the center with a small group of colleagues, including Presley and Representative Rashida Tlaib, proved traumatic. Ocasio-Cortez says she was forced to check her phone at the door. Then, once inside, CBP agents snapped photos of her. Presley remembers sitting on the floor of a cell with Ocasio-Cortez, surrounded by women in tears, speaking panicked Spanish. "It was freezing and not very clean, and Ocasio-Cortez refused to leave. We had to physically remove Alex," Presley recalls. Later, Ocasio-Cortez, Presley, and Tlaib took turns placing comforting hands on one another's backs as they spoke at a press conference alongside an angry mob. Soon after, Trump launched a now-infamous racist Twitter tirade urging Ocasio-Cortez, Presley, Tlaib, and Representative Ilhan Omar to go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came. The squad, as those four women are known, had begun with a serendipitous selfie at freshman orientation, but it is now a source of support that Ocasio-Cortez calls a gift from God. "There have been many times, especially in the first 6 months, where I felt like I couldn't do this, like I didn't know if I was going to be able to run for re-election," Ocasio-Cortez says. "There was a time where the volume of threats had gotten so high that I didn't even know if I was going to live to my next term." Their sisterhood and their friendship, it's not some political alliance. It's a very deep, unconditional human bond. A close friend had told her that giving up would have been the point of the threats. "It's to get you to destroy yourself so that they don't have to destroy you." That counsel helped Ocasio-Cortez reach a turning point, telling herself, "Okay, I'm not crazy. It's not that this is too much for me. It's that this is an environment with a very specific purpose." She tries to lighten the mood with a bit of black humor. "My family's very spiritual," she shrugs, putting on a classic New York accent. "When you go, you go." She laughs often at the outrageousness of her life. Maybe she has to. But for her own health, Ocasio-Cortez has tried to keep those men, and it is always men, in a faraway mental compartment. "All these dudes look the same. I got to a point where I was like, this isn't even helpful because it's all these neo-Nazis." Then, joking, "I shouldn't say that. There's great diversity in the neo-Nazis." "When I hear she gets threats, I always pray for her," says Tim Burkett, Republican from Tennessee, who affectionately calls her Cortez. Yes, AOC has Republican friends. "I don't agree with a doggone thing she says," Burkett says, "but I respect her right to represent her constituents just as much as she respects mine." Exaltation weighs heavy, too. Ocasio-Cortez's charisma and raw talent are often compared to Barack Obama's. Not 3 years into her congressional career, speculation abounds about a future presidential run, with everyone from Howard Dean to Cardi B rooting for it. No sooner had Kamala Harris been chosen as Joe Biden's running mate than chatter began bubbling about a 2024 primary between Harris and Ocasio-Cortez, who turned 31 in October and would only narrowly make the 35-year-old age requirement. I've told her I fully expect that she's going to run one day, and that she should. Former Housing and Urban Development Secretary and 2020 candidate Julian Castro told me, she absolutely has the talent, the dynamism, and the leadership ability. At Ocasio-Cortez's census awareness event in the Bronx's Pelham Bay Park, women approached the congresswoman to cry, gush, and hug. Pandemic be damned, AOC in a pale blue suit, matching mask, and beige Rothy's opens her arms and indulges every selfie request. I can't wait until you are president someday, says one. Another, Jessica Forbes, grabs a selfie with her and tells me she's going to be our Bernie Sanders. In 2016, Ocasio-Cortez was a volunteer organizer for Sanders in the Bronx. 3 years later, she became the most crucial backer of his 2020 presidential campaign, at a time when her support was also highly coveted by Elizabeth Warren. She endorsed me right after I had a heart attack, and there were some people who were writing our campaign off. I've always been very grateful to her for doing that, says Sanders. There are some politicians who are very good on policy, and there are some politicians who are good communicators, and there are some politicians that have a way about them that relates very well to ordinary people, says Sanders. Alexandria has all three of those characteristics. Despite the base level of ego required to run for any office, Ocasio-Cortez seems uncomfortable with the mania about her future. I think it's part of our cultural understanding of politics, where if you think someone is great, you automatically think they should be president, she says. I joke, I'm like, is Congress not good enough? Her aspirations are a matter of endless speculation. New York Senate, House leadership, a cabinet post. I don't know if I'm really going to be staying in the House forever, or if I do stay in the House, what that would look like, she says. I don't see myself really staying where I am at for the rest of my life. This is one of the few times AOC seems guarded and cautious about her words. I don't want to aspire to a quote-unquote higher position just for the sake of that title, or just for the sake of having a different or higher position. I truly make an assessment to see if I can be more effective. And so, you know, I don't know if I could necessarily be more effective in an administration, but for me, that's always what the question comes down to. She does not believe in political messiahs, nor does she see herself as a hierarchical, power-based person. At the beginning of her first term, her staff still called her Alex. It is only when journalists on the Hill started to follow suit that her team collectively decided to address her as Congresswoman. She blends into the crowd at Pelham Bay Park, even though she's the only one in a suit. When a nearby gender reveal party pops a blue confetti cannon, she throws her hands in the air and cheers. When I ask Presley what the popular narratives miss, she cites humility. She certainly did not set out to be an icon or even a history maker. I think it was her destiny, but there is no calculation. As Ocasio-Cortez puts it, I don't want to be a savior. I want to be a mirror. The eventual champion of the Green New Deal grew up in a jungle-themed bedroom in suburban Yorktown, New York, with a monkey and a tree painted on the walls. Sandy was always someone who was heavily into science and would nerd out at times, says Rebecca Rodriguez, her cousin and 2020 campaign manager. The word nerd comes up often among her inner circle. The whole family is Star Trek obsessed. In high school, AOC won an award at the Intel International Science and Engineering Fair, something about the lifespan of roundworms, which led scientists to name an asteroid in her honor. Somewhere between Mars and Jupiter floats 23238 Ocasio-Cortez. According to the experts who named it, there's zero chance it will destroy us. AOC's first taste of activism came as a 12-year-old Girl Scout who noticed the pond outside her Yorktown Middle School was brown, nasty, and devoid of aquatic life. "Where are the frogs?" she wondered. Realizing it needed an aerator, young Ocasio-Cortez gave an impassioned presentation to the town board alongside middle-aged men seeking backyard deck permits. "She didn't get the aerator," she says, "but it was the first time that I realized that there's a world outside of school that I could change." Her life has shaped her platform. From a young age, she detected the inequity between her nuclear family unit and the grandparents, aunts, uncles, and cousins who lived 30 miles south in the Bronx, where she was born. Ocasio-Cortez's family was the only one to have a house, hosting Nochebuenas in their modest two-bedroom. She spent weekends in her old neighborhood, playing handball and buying caramels at the bodega with cousins as close as siblings, but there was a gaping maw between her everyday life and theirs. Her cousins walked through metal detectors at school and skirted gang turf outside. "If you wear the wrong colors in the wrong neighborhood," Ocasio-Cortez says, "you'll get jumped and your chain will be taken." She blames the insane stresses of inequality, incidentally the position that drew Yoho's ire. Believing in the dignity of working people began at home. Her father, Sergio, was an architect and small business owner who grew up when the Bronx was burning. He wanted to be one of the people that helped put the buildings back up, she says. Her mother, who came from Puerto Rico as an adult, cleaned the homes of Yorktown's wealthier, overwhelmingly white residents. Ocasio-Cortez scarcely fit in the standardized test boxes, Gabriel recalled, but hyphenating Sergio's last name in front of Blanca's sent a foundational message. "We started out from the jump, seeing that our mom is equal to our dad." Still growing up as some of the only Puerto Rican kids in Yorktown meant Sandy or Gabe sometimes came home crying. At the end of the day, she was a brown girl, and she didn't have crimped hair like the rest of the 90s kids, Gabriel says of his sister. She wasn't ever going to be the sleepover house. Sergio's death from lung cancer in 2008, during Ocasio-Cortez's sophomore year at Boston University, altered the trajectory of her life. "I don't think there's any way to overstate how close I was with my dad," she says. Sergio doted on Sandy, and he challenged her. That sense of ambition to try things when the odds seem so unfavorable, that very, very much comes from my father. Losing him emotionally devastated her. It felt like I didn't just lose my dad, I also lost myself. But she wouldn't let grief lay her low. "We're not an 'oh, boo-hoo, this happened to me, give me attention' type of family," Gabriel says. A week after Sergio died, Ocasio-Cortez returned to college, laser-focused. Her GPA improved that semester. "This isn't just about me anymore," as her close friend John Bertrand Uliana sums it up. "I need to take care of my family." She became an adult before any of us. According to Rodriguez, Sergio's death put a fire under her. Next photos, daughter of the revolution. Sandy, as her family calls her, with her father, Sergio. The congresswoman addresses Representative Ted Yoho's epithets from the House floor. During the oft-overlooked pre-bartender portion of AOC's resume, she studied abroad in Niger, doing rotations at a maternity clinic, and interned in the late Senator Ted Kennedy's office before graduating cum laude with $25,000 in student debt. A friend says she would have been a prime candidate for an MBA or a lucrative consulting job at McKinsey. Instead, she became educational director at the National Hispanic Institute, and long before the rise of the anti-racist reading list, founded Brook Avenue Press to produce children's books that reflected her Bronx community. Losing Sergio had thrown the family's finances into tumult. Their home in Yorktown was almost repossessed multiple times, sparking a protracted probate battle in local court. Blanca took a second job driving school buses, and as the AOC origin story often highlights, Ocasio-Cortez began waitressing and bartending at Flats Fix in Manhattan's Union Square. It's pretty simple, but also profound, says Alexandra Rojas, executive director of Justice Democrats, the upstart progressive group that first recruited AOC to run. This is the story of a young Latina who's trying to put food on the table for her family. It should not be groundbreaking for a political candidate's life to closely resemble that of her constituents, but AOC's rise has proved the power of proximity. When a majority of Congress members are millionaires, having lived on the edge of poverty, Ocasio-Cortez says, makes me better at my job than 90% of Republicans because I've actually worked for a living. While still waitressing at the outset of her 2018 run, she changed her shoes on the subway platform and pushed a granny cart full of flyers and posters around the Bronx. She swiffered the steps of her own campaign office and lugged in an air mattress as a makeshift couch. She stomped in a pair of sneakers by the brand and other stories until they were toast. They were later displayed in a museum at Cornell University. Neither the financial collapse nor the fundamentally broken healthcare system were abstracts for Ocasio-Cortez, a vocal supporter of Medicare for All and a persistent critic of the Affordable Care Act. The main reason why I feel comfortable saying that the ACA has failed, is because it failed me, and it failed everyone that I worked with in a restaurant, she says. She would take wads of cash tips to doctor appointments. You try buying insurance off of Obamacare, she tells me, a line meant for her out-of-touch colleagues. As a bartender, she did buy a plan, paying $200 per month, she says, for the privilege of an $8,000 deductible. For a while after she was sworn in, even with a snazzy congressional insurance plan, Ocasio-Cortez says, she still rolled to the pharmacy and paid cash for her prescriptions out of habit. The first time she saw a doctor or dentist in years was when she became a congresswoman. Growing up, her parents were natural organizers among the largely Latinx immigrant underclass in affluent Westchester County. My dad would get coffee every day at the town Dunkin' Donuts, and we would invite the cashiers over for dinner, Ocasio-Cortez says. This background informed her persistent calls for the abolition of ICE. The Democratic Party has been, and this dates back to the Obama administration, extremely weak on developing just immigration policy because we're scared of our own shadow. Critics have seized on her working-class roots, taunting her for having been a bartender, while pointing at her wardrobe and D.C. rental as an attempt to expose her as a bougie fabulist. The scrutiny used to sting to have to announce that your mother was scrubbing toilets, that our family was struggling to do basic things, that they almost repossessed our home several times, Gabriel Ocasio-Cortez says. But in the long term, it only casts further light into who we are. Just decent people. Decent people are relatable. The irony is that the things Republicans say about her are things that she used to say about herself. Fearing she was failing to make her late father proud, I used to, frankly, abuse myself mentally about how I'm nothing, Ocasio-Cortez says. I realized that I need to choose myself, because if I don't, I'm just going to waste away. I'm just going to give up. In her own way, Ocasio-Cortez is continuing Sergio's legacy of building up the Bronx. If he were around today, I think he would make fun of me incessantly, and he'd be the first one to call me a communist, she laughs, but he would be in my corner, too. With a congressional salary now, $174,000, stretched over two of the most expensive cities in America, dressing for the job remains fraught. It's legitimately hard being a first-generation woman, and being working class, trying to navigate a professional environment, Ocasio-Cortez tells me at our Bronx breakfast, where she wears a rust-colored suede moto jacket and a Black Panthers t-shirt. She asks for more hot sauce and never once checks her phone. It continues to take me so long to try to figure out how to look put together without having a huge designer closet. Unlike the Kennedys and Bushes, she was not groomed for politics or even corporate America. No one ever conveyed to her the nuances of business casual or business formal, which is why, unlike so many female politicians past, she's willing to talk about her appearance with her 7.2 million Instagram followers. Next photo, A Bronx Tale. Ocasio-Cortez photographed with residents in her original borough on the corner of Kruger and Bronxdale Avenues. And Radical Chic. AOC says dressing the part has been an unexpected struggle, but it's also a way to connect with constituents. AOC is the perhaps only member of Congress who moonlights as a beauty influencer, sharing her go-to red gloss, Stila's Stay All Day Liquid and Beso, translated to a sales spike. Every time I go on TV, people ask for my lipstick, she says. On TikTok, the Yoho speech has become a popular lip sync for makeup tutorials. One young girl applies winged eyeliner while mouthing, "He called me dangerous." But like Ruth Bader Ginsburg's prickly dissent collar, Ocasio-Cortez's appearance is a study in meaning. The gold hoops and red lips she wore to her first swearing-in were a cosmetic bat signal to Latina culture and a nod to fellow Bronx native Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who was told not to rock bright nails at her confirmation hearings. The squad has claimed crimson lips as a show of strength. As the congresswomen furiously scrawled talking points before the press conference responding to Trump's go-back attack, Presley called out, "Who needs lipstick?" and passed around a tube. "Now," says Presley, "any time we think a day is going to be especially trying, where one of us walks into a committee hearing wearing a bold red lip, we say, 'Oh, it's about to go down.'" Ocasio-Cortez notably delivered the Yoho speech in her trademark Beso Red. Afterward, Presley said to her, "You know how I know you showed up to do business? Because you matched your lip with your suit." Ocasio-Cortez recalls, "Ayanna was like, 'That's when I knew she didn't come to play.'" Ocasio-Cortez acknowledges that she had, in fact, come to the floor in bold colors to give herself a little extra confidence. "I had a little war paint on that day, for sure." The job leaves little time for normal life. Before taking office, she did yoga four times a week. Now, the notion of self-care is a daily struggle. Her family worries about the toll. Her mother will, on occasion, call me and be like, "Is she okay? Is she eating?" Rodriguez says. "We all know when she loses too much weight. It's a sign that she is really stressed out." Earlier this year, Ocasio-Cortez and Roberts got a French bulldog named Deco, an ode to the architectural style, to force myself to not live and breathe work, she says. Dog motherhood is the only kind she can fathom at the moment. I'm sitting here, I'm like, do I freeze my eggs? Can I afford to do that? The congresswoman says, laughing. My orthodontist was telling me about how she was doing IVF, and I'm like asking her what her experience is like. As the youngest congresswoman in history, she's in uncharted family planning territory. It's important for us to talk about it, because women, we have to make these choices that men simply don't have to make. Very few women have. Ocasio-Cortez trails off. Before pointing to Tammy Duckworth as a model, for now she's Titi Sandy, a variation of Tia, aunt to Rodriguez's three children, two of whom walked hand in hand with her to her swearing-in ceremony. Staffer's kids are welcome in her Bronx campaign office, which boasts copious snacks and a toy corner. Being around children is Ocasio-Cortez's happy place, Rodriguez says. Staffers once lost track of her at a block party, only to find her sitting cross-legged on the ground with a cluster of kids. Ocasio-Cortez seems to have found her Marty Ginsburg in Roberts, a web developer and Arizona native whom she met in college and connected with at a weekly coffee and conversations discussion series. I think people see how glamorous she is, but these were not two glamorous people, the couple's friend Raul Fernandez says. These were two awkward, super smart, like to talk about issues kind of people that met through this super wonky, nerdy thing. Ocasio-Cortez often delivered the final word at those Friday afternoon talks, while Roberts raised antagonistic counterpoints for argument's sake. In their liberal university bubble, it becomes pretty easy for everyone to basically have the same thinking, William Amno said. That always bothered Riley. The weekend before Election Day, 2018, William Amna rented a cabin for the three of them in Woodstock, and they made plans for what would happen if she lost. Maybe buying this massive church that was for sale, he says, or we can just start a ranch and stay up here forever. Roberts featured prominently in Knock Down the House, filming Ocasio-Cortez on his cell phone at debates, poring over her digital ad strategy, in which he has played a crucial role, and crying behind his red glasses as the two gaze up at the Capitol after her primary victory. But his role in the film was uncharacteristic. Roberts is intensely private, declining interview requests, including this one, and appearing only sporadically in his partner's Instagram stories. Not long ago, he ran after Deco in slow motion on the front lawn of the Capitol. When the camera is on her, he steps out of the way, says Fernandez. Those who know the couple call Roberts good people, a keeper, and a genuinely wonderful person. At the Sundance Film Festival premiere of Knock Down the House, Roberts was just bawling during scenes around Sergio's death, Fernandez says. I was like, he really deeply loves this woman. What more can you ask for? My interviews with Ocasio-Cortez come at a precarious moment in history. Before Election Day 2020, during a series of news cycles that are stunning, even by Trumpian standards. When we first sat down in her Bronx office, the New York Times had just published its bombshell investigation of Trump's taxes. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.